This is Audible.
The Farseer, Assassin's Apprentice, by Robin Hobb. Narrated by Paul Bamer. Copyright 1995, by Robin Hobb. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Robin Hobb, care of Ralph Vicinanza, Limited, and was produced in the year 2010 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. 1. The Earliest History. A history of the six duchies is of necessity a history of its ruling family, the Farseers. A complete telling would reach back beyond the founding of the first duchy and, if such names were remembered, would tell us of out-islanders raiding from the sea, visiting as pirates a shore more temperate and gentler than the icy beaches of the out-islands. But we do not know the names of these earliest forebears, and of the first real king, little more than his name and some extravagant legends remain. Taker, his name was, quite simply. And perhaps with that naming began the tradition that daughters and sons of his lineage would be given names that would shape their lives and being. Folk beliefs claim that such names were sealed to the newborn babes by magic, and that these royal offspring were incapable of betraying the virtues whose names they bore. Passed through fire, and plunged through salt water, and offered to the winds of the air, thus were names sealed to these chosen children. So we are told. A pretty fancy. And perhaps once there was such a ritual. But history shows us this was not always sufficient to bind a child to the virtue that named it. My pen falters, then falls from my knuckly grip, leaving a worm's trail of ink across Fedrin's paper. I have spoiled another leaf of the fine stuff in what I suspect is a futile endeavor. I wonder if I can write this history, or if on every page there will be some sneaking show of a bitterness I thought long dead. I think myself cured of all spite, but when I touch pen to paper, the hurt of a boy bleeds out with the sea-spawned ink, until I suspect each carefully formed black letter scabs over some ancient scarlet wound. Both Fedrin and Patience were so filled with enthusiasm whenever a written account of the history of the six duchies was discussed, that I persuaded myself the writing of it was a worthwhile effort. I convinced myself that the exercise would turn my thoughts aside from my pain and help the time to pass. But each historical event I consider only awakens my own personal shades of loneliness and loss. I fear I will have to set this work aside entirely, or else give in to reconsidering all that has shaped what I have become. And so I begin again, and again, but always find that I am writing of my own beginnings rather than the beginnings of this land. I do not even know to whom I try to explain myself. My life has been a web of secrets, secrets that even now are unsafe to share. Shall I set them all down on fine paper, only to create from them flame and ash? Perhaps. My memories reach back to when I was 6 years old. Before that, there is nothing. Only a blank gulf no exercise of my mind has ever been able to pierce. Prior to that day at Moon's Eye, there is nothing. But on that day they suddenly begin, with a brightness and detail that overwhelms me. Sometimes it seems too complete, and I wonder if it is truly mine. Am I recalling it from my own mind, or from dozens of retellings by legions of kitchen maids and ranks of scullions and herds of stable boys, as they explained my presence to each other? Perhaps I have heard the story so many times from so many sources that I now recall it as an actual memory of my own. Is the detail the result of a six-year-old's open absorption of all that goes on around him? Or Could the completeness of the memory be the bright overlay of the skill? And the later drugs a man takes to control his addiction to it, the drugs that bring on pains and cravings of their own? The last is most possible. Perhaps it is even probable. One hopes it is not the case. The remembrance is almost physical, the chill greyness of the fading day, the remorseless rain that soaked me, the icy cobbles of the strange town's streets, even the calloused roughness of the huge hand that gripped my small one. Sometimes I wonder about that grip. The hand was hard and rough, trapping mine within it. And yet it was warm, and not unkind as it held mine, only firm. It did not let me slip on the icy streets, but it did not let me escape my fate either. It was as implacable as the icy grey rain that glazed the trampled snow and ice of the gravelled pathway outside the huge wooden doors of the fortified building that stood like a fortress within the town itself. The doors were tall, not just to a 6-year-old boy, but tall enough to admit giants, to dwarf even the rangy old men who towered over me. And they looked strange to me, although I cannot summon up what type of door or dwelling would have looked familiar. Only that these, carved and bound with black iron hinges, decorated with a buck's head and knocker of gleaming brass, were outside of my experience. I recall that slush had soaked through my clothes, so my feet and legs were wet and cold, and yet, again, I cannot recall that I had walked far through winter's last curses, nor that I had been carried. No. It all starts there, right outside the doors of the strong house, with my small hand trapped inside the tall man's. Almost, it is like a puppet show beginning. Yes, I can see it thus. The curtains parted, and there we stood before that great door. The old man lifted the brass knocker and banged it down once, twice, thrice, on the plate that resounded to his pounding. And then, from off stage, a voice sounded, not from within the doors, but from behind us, back the way we had come. "Father, please!" the woman's voice begged. I turned to look at her, but it had begun to snow again, a lacy veil that clung to eyelashes and coat sleeves. I can't recall that I saw any more. Certainly I did not struggle to break free of the old man's grip on my hand, nor did I call out, "Mother, mother!" Instead, I stood, a spectator, and heard the sound of boots within the keep and the unfastening of the door-hasp within. One last time she called. I can still hear the words perfectly, the desperation in a voice that now would sound young to my ears. "Father, please, I beg you." A tremor shook the hand that gripped mine, but whether of anger or some other emotion I shall never know. As swift as a black crow seizes a bit of dropped bread, the old man stooped and snatched up a frozen chunk of dirty ice. Wordlessly he flung it, with great force and fury. And I cowered where I stood. I do not recall a cry, nor the sound of struck flesh. What I do remember is how the doors swung outward, so that the old man had to step hastily back, dragging me with him. And there is this. The man who opened the door was no house servant, as I might imagine if I had only heard this story. No, memory shows me a man-at-arms, a warrior, gone a bit to grey and with a belly more of hard suet than muscle, but not some mannered house-servant. He looked both the old man and me up and down with a soldier's practiced suspicion, and then stood there, silently, waiting for us to state our business. I think it rattled the old man a bit, and stimulated him not to fear, but to anger. For he suddenly dropped my hand and instead gripped me by the back of my coat and swung me forward like a whelp offered to a prospective new owner. "I brought the boy to you," he said in a rusty voice. and when the house guard continued to stare at him without judgment or even curiosity, he elaborated. "I've fed him at my table for 6 years, and never a word from his father, never a coin, never a visit, though my daughter gives me to understand he knows he fathered a bastard on her. I'll not feed him any longer, nor break my back at a plough to keep clothes on his back. Let him be fed by him what got him. I've got enough to tend to of my own, what with my woman getting on in years, and this one's mother to keep and feed, for not a man will have her now, not a man, not with this pup running at her heels. So you take him, and give him to his father." And he let go of me so suddenly that I sprawled to the stone doorstep at the guard's feet. I scrambled to a sitting position, not much hurt that I recall, and looking up to see what would happen next between the two men. The guard looked down at me, lips pursed slightly, not in judgment, but merely considering how to classify me. "Who's Get?" he asked, and his tone was not one of curiosity, but only that of a man who asks for more specific information on a situation in order to report well to a superior. "Chivalries," the old man said, and he was already turning his back on me, taking his measured steps down the graveled pathway. "Prince Chivalry," he said, not turning back as he added the qualifier. "Him what's king in waiting. That's who got him. So let him do for him, and be glad he managed to father one child somewhere." For a moment, the guard watched the old man walking away. Then he wordlessly stooped to seize me by the collar and drag me out of the way so he could close the door. He let go of me for the brief time it took him to secure the door. That done, he stood looking down on me. No real surprise, only a soldier's stoic acceptance of the odder bits of his duty. "Up, boy, and walk," he said. So I followed him, down a dim corridor, past rooms spartanly furnished with windows still shuttered against winter's chill, and finally to another set of closed doors, these of rich, mellow wood, embellished with carvings. There he paused, and straightened his own garments briefly. I remember quite clearly how he went down on one knee to tug my shirt straight and smooth my hair with a rough pat or two. But whether this was from some kind-hearted impulse that I make a good impression, or merely a concern that his package look well tended, I will never know. He stood again and knocked once at the double doors. Having knocked, he did not wait for a reply, or at least, I never heard one. He pushed the doors open, herded me in before him, and shut the doors behind him. This room was as warm as the corridor had been chill, and alive as the other chambers had been deserted. I recall a quantity of furniture in it, rugs and hangings, and shelves of tablets and scrolls overlaid with the scattering of clutter that any well-used and comfortable chamber takes on. There was a fire burning in a massive fireplace, filling the room with heat and a pleasantly resinous scent. An immense table was placed at an angle to the fire, and behind it sat a stocky man, his brows knit as he bent over a sheaf of papers in front of him. He did not look up immediately, and so I was able to study his rather bushy disarray of dark hair for some moments. When he did look up, he seemed to take in both myself and the guard in one quick glance of his black eyes. "Well, Jason?" he asked, and even at that age I could sense his resignation to a messy interruption. "What's this?" The guard gave me a gentle nudge on the shoulder that propelled me a foot or so closer to the man. "An old ploughman left him, Prince Verity, sir. Says it's Prince Chivalry's bastard, sir." For a few moments, the harried man behind the desk continued to regard me with some confusion. Then something very like an amused smile lightened his features, and he rose and came around the desk to stand with his fists on his hips, looking down on me. I did not feel threatened by his scrutiny. Rather, it was as if something about my appearance pleased him inordinately. I looked up at him curiously. He wore a short, dark beard, as bushy and disorderly as his hair, and his cheeks were weathered above it. Heavy brows were raised above his dark eyes. He had a barrel of a chest, and shoulders that strained the fabric of his shirt. His fists were square and work-scarred, yet ink stained the fingers of his right hand. As he stared at me, his grin gradually widened, until finally he gave a snort of laughter. "Be damned," he finally said. "Boy does have Shiv's look to him, doesn't he? Fruitful Ida. Who'd have believed it of my illustrious and virtuous brother?" The guard made no response at all, nor was one expected from him. He continued to stand alertly, awaiting the next command. A soldier's soldier. The other man continued to regard me curiously. "How old?" he asked the guard.
"Plowman says 6.
The guard raised a hand to scratch at his neck, then suddenly seemed to recall he was reporting. He dropped his hand.
"Sir,"
he added. The other didn't seem to notice the guard's lapse in discipline. The dark eyes roved over me, and the amusement in his smile grew broader. "So make it 7 years or so to allow for her belly to swell." Damn, yes! That was the first year the Chiorda tried to close the pass. Chivalry was up this way for 3-4 months, chivying them into opening it to us. Looks like it wasn't the only thing he shivved open. Damn! Who'd have thought it of him? He paused, then... "Who's the mother?" he demanded suddenly. The guardsman shifted uncomfortably.
"Don't know, sir. There was only the old ploughman on the doorstep, and all him said was that this was Prince Chivalry's bastard, and he wasn't going to feed him nor put clothes on his back no more. Said him what got him could care for him now."
The man shrugged as if the matter were of no great importance. "The boy looks well tended. I give it a week, a fortnight at most, before she's whimpering at the kitchen door because she misses her pup. I'll find out then, if not before. Here, boy, what do they call you?" His jerkin was closed with an intricate buckle shaped like a buck's head. It was brass, then gold, then red as the flames in the fireplace moved. "Boy," I said. I do not know if I was merely repeating what he and the guardsman had called me, or if I truly had no name besides the word. For a moment, the man looked surprised, and a look of what might have been pity crossed his face. But it disappeared as swiftly, leaving him looking only discomforted or mildly annoyed. He glanced back at the map that still awaited him on the table. "Well," he said, into the silence. "Something's got to be done with him, at least until Shiv gets back. Jason, see the boys fed and bedded somewhere, at least for tonight. I'll give some thought to what's to be done with him tomorrow. Can't have royal bastards cluttering up the countryside."
"Sir,"
said Jason, neither agreeing nor disagreeing, but merely accepting the order. He put a heavy hand on my shoulder and turned me back toward the door. I went, somewhat reluctantly, for the room was bright and pleasant and warm. My cold feet had started to tingle, and I knew if I could stay a little longer, I would be warmed through. But the guardsman's hand was inexorable, and I was steered out of the warm chamber and back into the chill dimness of the drear corridors. They seemed all the darker after the warmth and light, and endless as I tried to match the guard's stride as he wound through them. Perhaps I whimpered, or perhaps he grew tired of my slower pace, for he spun suddenly, seized me, and tossed me up to sit on his shoulder as casually as if I weighed nothing at all.
"Soggy little pup, you,"
he observed without rancor, and then bore me down corridors and around turns and up and down steps, and finally into the yellow light and space of a large kitchen. There, half a dozen other guards lounged on benches and ate and drank at a big scarred table before a fire fully twice as large as the one in the study had been. The room smelled of food,
of beer and men's sweat, of wet wool garments and the smoke of the wood and drip of grease into flames. Hogsheads and small casks ranged against the wall, and small joints of meats were dark shapes hung from the rafters. The table bore a clutter of food and dishes. A chunk of meat on a spit was swung back from the flames and dripping fat onto the stone hearth. My stomach clutched suddenly at my ribs at the rich smell. Jason set me rather firmly on the corner of the table closest to the fire's warmth, jogging the elbow of a man whose face was hidden by a mug.
"Here, Burridge," Jason said matter-of-factly. "This pup's for you now."
He turned away from me. I watched with interest as he broke a corner as big as his fist off a dark loaf, and then drew his belt knife to take a wedge of cheese off a wheel. He pushed these into my hands, and then, stepping to the fire, began sawing a man-sized portion of meat off the joint. I wasted no time in filling my mouth with bread and cheese. Beside me, the man called Burridge set down his mug and glared around at Jason.
"What's this?"
he asked, sounding very much like the man in the warm chamber. He had the same unruly blackness to his hair and beard, but his face was angular and narrow. His face had the color of a man much outdoors. His eyes were brown rather than black, and his hands were long-fingered and clever. He smelled of horses and dogs and blood and leathers.
"He's yours to watch over, Burridge. Prince Verity says so."
"Why?"
"You're chivalry's man, ain't you? Care for his horse, his hounds, and his hawks?"
"So?"
"So? You got his little bastard. At least until chivalry gets back and does otherwise with him."
Jason offered me the slab of dripping meat. I looked from the bread to the cheese I gripped, loath to surrender either, but longing for the hot meat, too. He shrugged at seeing my dilemma, and with a fighting man's practicality, flipped the meat casually onto the table beside my hip. I stuffed as much bread into my mouth as I could, and shifted to where I could watch the meat.
"Chivalry's bastard?"
Jason shrugged, busy with getting himself bread and meat and cheese of his own.
"So said the old ploughman what left him here."
He layered the meat and cheese into a slab of bread, took an immense bite, and then spoke through it.
"Said chivalry ought to be glad he'd seeded one child somewhere, and should feed and care for him himself now."
An unusual quiet bloomed suddenly in the kitchen. Men paused in their eating, gripping bread or mugs or trenchers, and turned eyes to the man called Burridge. He himself set his mug carefully away from the edge of the table. His voice was quiet and even, his words precise.
"If my master has no heir, 'tis Ida's will and no fault of his manhood. The Lady Patience has always been delicate and—"
"Even so, even so,"
Jason was quickly agreeing.
"And there sits the very proof that there's nought wrong with him as a man. As is all I was saying, that's all."
He wiped his mouth hastily on his sleeve.
"As like to Prince Chivalry as can be, as even his brother said but a while ago. Not the Crown Prince's fault if his Lady Patience can't carry his seat to term."
But Burridge had stood suddenly. Jason backed a hasty step or two before he realized I was Burridge's target, not him. Burridge gripped my shoulders and turned me to the fire. When he firmly took my jaw in his hand and lifted my face to his, he startled me, so that I dropped both bread and cheese. Yet he paid no mind to this as he turned my face toward the fire and studied me as if I were a map. His eyes met mine, and there was a sort of wildness in them, as if what he saw in my face were an injury I'd done to him. I started to draw away from that look, but his grip wouldn't let me. So I stared back at him with as much defiance as I could muster, and saw his upset masked suddenly with a sort of reluctant wonder. And lastly, he closed his eyes for a second, hooding them against some pain. It's a thing that will try her lady's will to the edge of her very name," Burridge said softly. He released my jaw and stooped awkwardly to pick up the bread and cheese I'd dropped. He brushed them off and handed them back to me. I stared at the thick bandaging on his right calf and over his knee that had kept him from bending his leg. He reseated himself and refilled his mug from a pitcher on the table. He drank again, studying me over the rim of his mug.
"Who'd chivalry get on him?"
a man at the other end of the table asked incautiously. Burridge swung his gaze to the man as he set his mug down. For a moment he didn't speak, and I sensed that silence hovering again. "I'd say it was Prince Chivalry's business who the mother was, and not for kitchen talk," Burridge said mildly.
"Even so, even so,"
the guard agreed abruptly, and Jason nodded like a courting bird in agreement. Young as I was, I still wondered what kind of a man this was who, with one leg bandaged, could quell a room full of rough men with a look or a word.
"Boy don't have a name,"
Jason volunteered into the silence.
"Just goes by Boy."
This statement seemed to put everyone, even Burridge, at a loss for words. The silence lingered as I finished bread and cheese and meat, and washed it down with a swallow or two of beer that Burridge offered me. The other men left the room gradually, in twos and threes, and still he sat there, drinking and looking at me.
"Well,"
he said at long last, "if I know your father, he'll face up to it square and do what's right. But Ida only knows what he'll think is the right thing to do. Probably whatever hurts the most." He watched me silently a moment longer. "Had enough to eat?" he asked at last. I nodded, and he stood stiffly to swing me off the table and onto the floor.
"Come on then, Fitz," he said,
and moved out of the kitchen and down a different corridor. His stiff leg made his gait ungainly, and perhaps the beer had something to do with it as well. Certainly I had no trouble in keeping up. We came at last to a heavy door, and a guard who nodded us through with a devouring stare at me. Outside, a chill wind was blowing. All the ice and snow that had softened during the day had gone back to sharpness with the coming of night. The path cracked under my feet, and the wind seemed to find every crack and gap in my garments. My feet and leggings had been warmed by the kitchen's fire, but not quite dried, so the cold seized on them. I remember darkness, and the sudden tiredness that came over me, a terrible, weepy sleepiness that dragged at me as I followed the strange man with the bandaged leg through the chill, dark courtyard. There were tall walls around us, and guards moved intermittently atop them, dark shadows visible only as they blotted the stars occasionally from the sky. The cold bit at me, and I stumbled and slipped on the icy pathway. But something about Burridge did not permit me to whimper or beg quarter from him. Instead, I followed him doggedly. We reached a building, and he dragged open a heavy door. Warmth and animal smells and a dim yellow light spilled out. A sleepy stable boy sat up in his nest of straw, blinking like a rumpled fledgling. At a word from Burridge, he lay down again, curling up small in the straw and closing his eyes. We moved past him, Burridge dragging the door to behind us. He took the lantern that burned dimly by the door and led me on. I entered a different world then, a night world, where animals shifted and breathed in stalls, where hounds lifted their heads from their crossed forepaws to regard me with lambent eyes, green or yellow in the lantern's glow. Horses stirred as we passed their stalls. "Hawks are down at the far end," Burridge said as we passed stall after stall. I accepted it as something he thought I should know. "Here," he said finally.
"'This'll do. For now, anyway. I'm jigged if I know what else to do with you. If it weren't for the lady patients, I'd be thinking this a fine God's jest on the master. Here, Nosy, you just move over and make this boy a place in the straw. That's right. You cuddle up to Vixen there. She'll take you in, and give a good slash to any that think to bother you.' I found myself facing an ample box stall, populated with three hounds. They had roused and lay, stick tails thumping in the straw at Burrich's voice. I moved uncertainly in amongst them, and finally lay down next to an old bitch with a whitened muzzle and one torn ear. The older male regarded me with a certain suspicion. But the third was a half-grown pup, and Nosy welcomed me with ear-lickings, nose-nipping, and much pawing. I put an arm around him to settle him, and then cuddled in amongst them as Burrich had advised. He threw a thick blanket that smelled much of horse down over me. A very large grey horse in the next stall stirred suddenly, thumping a heavy hoof against the partition, and then hanging his head over to see what the night excitement was about. Burrich absently calmed him with a touch. "It's rough quarters here for all of us at this outpost. You'll find Buck Keep a more hospitable place, but for tonight you'll be warm here and safe." He stood a moment longer, looking down at us. Horse, hound, and hawk chivalry. "I've minded them all for you for many a year, and minded them well. But this byblow of yours, well, what to do with him is beyond me." I knew he wasn't speaking to me. I watched him over the edge of the blanket as he took the lantern from its hook and wandered off, muttering to himself. I remember that first night well, the warmth of the hounds, the prickling straw, and even the sleep that finally came as the pup cuddled close beside me. I drifted into his mind and shared his dim dreams of an endless chase, pursuing a quarry I never saw, but whose hot scent dragged me onward through nettle, bramble, and scree. And with the hound's dream, the precision of the memory wavers like the bright colours and sharp edges of a drug dream. Certainly the days that follow that first night have no such clarity in my mind. I recall the spitting wet days of winter's end as I learned the route from my stall to the kitchen. I was free to come and go there as I pleased. Sometimes there was a cook in attendance, setting meat onto the hearth hooks, or pummeling bread dough, or breaching a cask of drink. More often there was not, and I helped myself to whatever had been left out on the table, and shared generously with the pup that swiftly became my constant companion. Men came and went, eating and drinking, and regarding me with a speculative curiosity that I came to accept as normal. The men had a sameness about them, with their rough wool cloaks and leggings, their hard bodies and easy movements, and the crest of a leaping buck that each bore over his heart. My presence made some of them uncomfortable. I grew accustomed to the mutter of voices that began whenever I left the kitchen. Burrich was a constant in those days, giving me the same care he gave to chivalry's beasts. I was fed, watered, groomed, and exercised, said exercise usually coming in the form of trotting at his heels as he performed his other duties. But those memories are blurry, and details, such as those of washing or changing garments, have probably faded with a six-year-old's calm assumptions of such things as normal. Certainly I remember the hound pup, Nosy. His coat was red and slick and short, and bristly in a way that prickled me through my clothes when we shared the horse blanket at night. His eyes were green as copper ore, his nose the colour of cooked liver, and the insides of his mouth and tongue were mottled pink and black. When we were not eating in the kitchen, we wrestled in the courtyard or in the straw of the box stall. Such was my world, for however long it was I was there. Not too long, I think, for I do not recall the weather changing. All my memories of that time are of raw days and blustery wind, and snow and ice that partially melted each day,
but were restored by night's freezes. One other memory I have of that time, but it's not sharp-edged. Rather, it is warm and softly tinted, like a rich old tapestry seen in a dim room. I recall being roused from sleep by the pups wriggling and the yellow light of a lantern being held over me. Two men bent over me, but Burridge stood stiffly behind them, and I was not afraid. "Now you've wakened him," warned the one, and he was Prince Verity, the man from the warmly lit chamber of my first evening.
"So, he'll go back to sleep as soon as we leave. Damn him, he has his father's eyes as well. I swear I'd have known his blood, no matter where I saw him. There'll be no denying it to any that see him.
But have neither you nor Burridge the sense of a flea? Bastard or not, you don't stable a child among beasts. Was there nowhere else you could put him?"
The man who spoke was like Verity around the jaw and eyes. But there the resemblance ended. This man was younger by far. His cheeks were beardless, and his scented and smoothed hair was finer and brown. His cheeks and forehead had been stung to redness by the night's chill, but it was a new thing, not Verity's weathered ruddiness. And Verity dressed as his men dressed, in practical woolens of sturdy weave and subdued colours. Only the crest on his breast showed brighter, in gold and silver thread. But the younger man with him gleamed in scarlets and primrose, and his cloak drooped with twice the width of cloth needed to cover a man. The doublet that showed beneath it was a rich cream and laden with lace. The scarf at his throat was secured with a leaping stag done in gold, its single eye a winking green gem. And the careful turn of his words was like a twisted chain of gold, compared with the simple links of Verity's speech.
"Regal, I had given it no thought. What do I know of children? I turned him over to Burridge. He is chivalry's man, and as such he's cared for—"
"I meant no disrespect to the blood, sir," Burridge said in honest confusion. "I am chivalry's man, and I saw to the boy as I thought best. I could make him up a pallet in the guard-room, but he seems small to be in the company of such men, with their comings and goings at all hours, their fights and drinking and noise."
The tone of his words made his own distaste for their company obvious.
"Bedded here, he has quiet, and the pup is taken to him. And with my vixen to watch over him at night, no one could do him harm without her teeth taking a toll. My lords, I know little of children myself, and it seemed to me—"
"It's fine, Burridge, it's fine," Verity said quietly, cutting him off. "If it had to be thought about, I should have done the thinking. I left it to you, and I don't find fault with it. It's better than a lot of children have in this village, Eden knows. For here, for now, it's fine."
"It will have to be different when he comes back to Buckkeep." Regal did not sound pleased.
"Then our father wishes to return with us to Buckkeep." The question came from Verity.
"Our father does. My mother does not."
"Oh." Verity's tone indicated he had no interest in further discussing that. But Regal frowned and continued. "My mother, the Queen, is not at all pleased about any of this. She has counseled the King long, but in vain. Mother and I were for putting the boy aside. It is only good sense. We scarcely need more confusion in the line of succession."
"I see no confusion in it now, Regal."
Verity spoke evenly. "Chivalry, me, and then you. Then our cousin, August. This bastard would be a far fifth. I am well aware that you precede me. You need not flaunt it at me at every opportunity," Regal said coldly. He glared down at me. "I still think it would be better not to have him about. What if chivalry never does get a legal heir on patience? What if he chooses to recognize this boy? It could be very divisive to the nobles. Why should we tempt trouble? So say my mother and I. But our father the king is not a hasty man, as well we know. Shrewd is as shrewd does, as the common folk say. He forbade any settling of the matter. Regal,
he said in that way he has. "Don't do what you can't undo unless you've considered what you can't do once you've done it." Then he laughed. Regal himself gave a short, bitter laugh. "I weary so of his humour." "Oh," said Verity again, and I lay still and wondered if he were trying to sort out the king's words, or refraining from replying to his brother's complaint. You discern his real reasons, of course. Regal informed him. "Which is?" "He still favours chivalry." Regal sounded disgusted. "Despite everything, despite his foolish marriage and his eccentric wife, despite this mess, and now he thinks this will sway the people, make them warmer toward him. Prove he's a man, that chivalry can father a child. Or maybe prove he's a human and can make mistakes like the rest of them." Regal's tone betrayed that he agreed with none of this. "And this will make the people like him more? Support his future kingship more, that he fathered a child on some wild woman before he married his queen?" Verity sounded confused by the logic. I heard the sourness in Regal's voice. "So the king seems to think. Does he care nothing for the disgrace? But I suspect chivalry will feel differently about using his bastard in such a way, especially as it regards dear Patience. But the king has ordered that the bastard be brought to Buck Keep when you return." Regal looked down on me, as if ill-satisfied. Verity looked briefly troubled, but nodded. A shadow lay over Burridge's features that the yellow lamplight could not lift. "Has my master no say in this?" Burridge ventured to protest. "It seems to me that if he wants to settle a portion on the family of the boy's mother and set him aside, then why, surely, for the sake of my Lady Patience's sensibilities, he should be allowed that discretion." Prince Regal broke in with a snort of disdain. The time for discretion was before he rolled the wench. "The Lady Patience is not the first woman to have to face her husband's bastard. Everyone here knows of his existence. Verity's clumsiness saw to that. There's no point in trying to hide him. And as far as a royal bastard is concerned, none of us can afford to have such sensibilities, Burridge. To leave such a boy in a place like this is like leaving a weapon hovering over the king's throat. Surely even a houndsman can see that, and even if you can't, your master will." An icy harshness had come into Regal's voice, and I saw Burridge flinch from his voice as I had seen him cower from nothing else. It made me afraid, and I drew the blanket up over my head and burrowed deeper into the straw. Beside me, Vixen growled lightly in the back of her throat. I think it made Regal step back, but I cannot be sure. The men left soon after, and if they spoke any more than that, no memory of it lies within me. Time passed, and I think it was 2 or perhaps 3 weeks later that I found myself clinging to Burridge's belt and trying to wrap my short legs around a horse behind him as we left that chill village, and began what seemed to me an endless journey down to warmer lands. I suppose at some point chivalry must have come to see the bastard he had sired, and must have passed some sort of judgment on himself as regarded me. But I have no memory of such a meeting with my father. The only image I carry of him in my mind is from his portrait on the wall at Buck Keep. Years later, I was given to understand that his diplomacy had gone well indeed, securing a treaty and peace that lasted well into my teens, and earning the respect and even fondness of the Chiurda. In truth, I was his only failure that year. But I was a monumental one. He preceded us home to Buck Keep, where he abdicated his claim to the throne. By the time we arrived, he and Lady Patience were gone from court, to live as the Lord and Lady of Withywoods. I have been to Withywoods. Its name bears no relationship to its appearance. It is a warm valley, centered on a gently flowing river that carves a wide plain that nestles between gently rising and rolling foothills. The place to grow grapes and grain and plump children. It is a soft holding, far from the borders,
far from the politics of court, far from anything that had been chivalry's life up to then. It was a pasturing out, a gentle and genteel exile, for a man who would have been king. A velvet smothering for a warrior, and a silencing of a rare and skilled diplomat. And so I came to Buckkeep, sole child and bastard of a man I'd never know. Prince Verity became king-in-waiting, and Prince Regal moved up a notch in the line of succession. If all I had ever done was to be born and discovered, I would have left a mark across all the land for all time. I grew up fatherless and motherless in a court where all recognized me as a catalyst. And a catalyst I became. 2. New Boy. There are many legends about Taker, the first out islander to claim Buckkeep as the first duchy and the founder of the royal line. One is that the raiding voyage he was on was his first and only foray out from whatever cold, harsh island bore him. It is said that upon seeing the timbered fortifications of Buckkeep, he had announced, "If there's a fire and a meal there, I shan't be leaving again." And there was. And he didn't. But family rumor says that he was a poor sailor, made sick by the heaving water and saltfish rations that other out-islanders throve upon. That he and his crew had been lost for days upon the water, and if he had not managed to seize Buckkeep and make it his own crew would have drowned him. Nevertheless, the old tapestry in the Great Hall shows him as a well-thewed stalwart, grinning fiercely over the prow of his vessel as his oarsmen propel him toward an ancient Buckkeep of logs and poorly dressed stone. Buckkeep had begun its existence as a defensible position on a navigable river at the mouth of a bay with excellent anchorage. Some petty land chief whose name has been lost in the mists of history saw the potential for controlling trade on the river and built the first stronghold there. Ostensibly, he had built it to defend both river and bay from the out-islander raiders who came every summer to plunder up and down the river. What he had not figured on were the raiders that infiltrated his fortifications by treachery. The towers and walls became their toehold. They moved their occupations and domination up the river, and rebuilding his timber fort into towers and walls of dressed stone, finally made Buckkeep the heart of the first duchy, and eventually the capital of the kingdom of the six duchies. The ruling house of the six duchies, the Farseers, were descended from those out-islanders. They had, for several generations, kept up their ties with the out-islanders, making courting voyages and returning home with plump, dark brides of their own folk. And so the blood of the out-islanders still ran strong in the royal lines and the noble houses, producing children with black hair and dark eyes and muscled, stocky limbs. And with those attributes went a predilection for the skill, and all the dangers and weaknesses inherent in such blood. I had my share of that heritage, too. But my first experience of Buckkeep held nothing of history or heritage. I knew it only as an end place for a journey, a panorama of noise and people, carts and dogs and buildings and twisting streets that led finally to an immense stone stronghold on the cliffs that overlooked the city sheltered below it. Burridge's horse was weary, and his hooves slipped on the often slimy cobbles of the city streets. I held on grimly to Burridge's belt, too weary and aching even to complain. I craned my head up once to stare at the tall grey towers and walls of the keep above us. Even in the unfamiliar warmth of the sea breeze, it looked chill and forbidding. I leaned my forehead against his back and felt ill in the brackish, iodine smell of the immense water. And that was how I came to Buckkeep.
Burridge had quarters over the stables, not far from the mews. It was there he took me, along with the hounds and chivalry's hawk. He saw to the hawk first, for it was sadly bedraggled from the trip. The dogs were overjoyed to be home, and were suffused with a boundless energy that was very annoying to anyone as weary as I. Nosey bowled me over a half-dozen times before I could convey to his thick-skulled hound's mind that I was weary and half-sick and in no mood for play. He responded as any pup would, by seeking out his former littermates and immediately getting himself into a semi-serious fight with one of them that was quelled by a shout from Burridge. Chivalry's man he might be, but when he was at Buckkeep, he was the master of the hounds, hawks, and horses. His own beast seen to, he proceeded to walk through the stables, surveying all that had been done, or left undone, in his absence. Stable-boys, grooms, and falconers appeared as if by magic to defend their charges from any criticisms. I trotted at his heels for as long as I could keep up. It was only when I finally surrendered and sank wearily into a pile of straw that he appeared to notice me. A look of irritation and then great weariness passed across his face. "Here you, Cobb. Take young Fitz there to the kitchens and see that he's fed, and then bring him back up to my quarters." Cobb was a short, dark dog boy, perhaps 10 years old, who had just been praised over the health of a litter that had been whelped in Burridge's absence. Moments before, he had been basking in Burridge's approval. Now his grin faltered, and he looked at me dubiously. We regarded one another as Burridge moved off down the line of stalls with his entourage of nervous caretakers. Then the boy shrugged, and went into a half-crouch to face me.
"Are you hungry, then, Fitz? Shall we go find you a bite?"
he asked invitingly, in exactly the same tone as he had used to coax his puppies out where Burridge could see them. I nodded, relieved that he expected no more from me than from a puppy, and followed him. He looked back often to see if I was keeping up. No sooner were we outside the stables than Nosey came frolicking up to join me. The hound's evident affection for me raised me in Cobb's estimation, and he continued to speak to both of us in short, encouraging phrases, telling us there was food just ahead. "Come along now. No, don't go off sniffing after that cat. Come along now. There's some good fellows." The stables had been bustling, with Verity's men putting up their horses and gear, and Burridge finding fault with all that had not been done up to his standards in his absence. But as we drew closer to the inner keep, the foot traffic increased. Folk brushed by us on all manner of errands, a boy carrying an immense slab of bacon on his shoulder, a giggling cluster of girls, arms heavy with strewing reeds and heather, a scowling old man with a basket of flopping fish, and 3 young women in motley and bells, their voices ringing as merrily as their chimes. My nose informed me that we were getting closer to the kitchens, but the traffic increased proportionately, until we drew near a door with a veritable crush of people going in and out. Cobb stopped, and Nosey and I paused behind him, noses working appreciatively. He regarded the press of folk at the door and frowned to himself.
"Place is packed. Everyone's getting ready for the welcoming feast tonight, for Verity and Regal. Anyone who's anyone has come into Buckkeep for it. Word spread fast about chivalry's ducking out on the kingship. All the dukes have come, or sent a man to counsel about it. I hear even the Chiorda sent someone. To be sure, chivalry's treaties will be honored if chivalry is no longer about."
He halted, suddenly embarrassed, but whether it was because he was speaking of my father to the cause of his abdication, or because he was addressing a puppy and a 6-year-old as if they had intelligence, I am not sure. He glanced about, reassessing the situation.
"Wait here," he told us finally. "I'll slip in and bring something out for you, less chance of me getting stepped on, or caught. Now stay."
And he reinforced his command with a firm gesture of his hand.
I backed up to a wall and crouched down there, out of traffic's way, and Nosey sat obediently beside me. I watched admiringly as Cobb approached the door and slipped between the clustered folk, eeling smoothly into the kitchens. With Cobb out of sight, the more general populace claimed my attention. Largely the folk that passed us were serving people and cooks, with a scattering of minstrels and merchants and delivery folk. I watched them come and go with a weary curiosity. I had already seen too much that day to find them of great interest. Almost more than food, I desired a quiet place away from all this activity. I sat flat on the ground, my back against the sun-warmed wall of the keep, and put my forehead on my knees. Nosey leaned against me. Nosey's stick tail beating against the earth roused me. I lifted my face from my knees to perceive a tall pair of brown boots before me. My eyes travelled up rough leather pants and over a coarse wool shirt to a shaggy bearded face thatched with pepper-grey hair. The man, staring down at me, balanced a small dog on one shoulder. "You're the bastard, eh?" I had heard the word often enough to know it meant me, without grasping the fullness of its meaning. I nodded slowly. The man's face brightened with interest. "Hey!" he said loudly, no longer speaking to me, but to the folk coming and going. "Here's the bastard! Stiff as a stick, chivalry's byblow! Looks a fair bit like him, don't you say? Who's your mother, boy?" To their credit, most of the passing people continued to come and go with no more than a curious stare at the 6-year-old sitting by the wall. But the caskman's question was evidently of great interest, for more than a few heads turned, and several tradesmen who had just exited from the kitchen drew nearer to hear the answer. But I did not have an answer. Mother had been mother, and whatever I had known of her was already fading, so I made no reply, but only stared up at him.
"Hey, what's your name then, boy?"
And turning to his audience, he confided,
"I heard he ain't got no name, no high-flown royal name to shape him, nor even a cottage name to scold him by. That right, boy? You got a name?"
The group of onlookers was growing. A few showed pity in their eyes, but none interfered. Some of what I was feeling passed to Nosey, who dropped over onto his side and showed his belly in supplication, while thumping his tail in that ancient canine signal that always means, "I'm only a puppy. I cannot defend myself. Have mercy." Had they been dogs, they would have sniffed me over and then drawn back. But humans have no such inbred courtesies. So when I didn't answer, the man drew a step nearer and repeated,
"You got a name, boy?"
I stood slowly, and the wall that had been warm against my back a moment ago was now a chill barrier to retreat. At my feet, Nosey squirmed in the dust on his back and let out a pleading whine.
"No,"
I said softly, and when the man made as if to lean closer to hear my words,
"No!"
I shouted and repelled at him, while crabbing sideways along the wall. I saw him stagger a step backward, losing his grip on his cask, so that it fell to the cobbled path and cracked open. No one in the crowd could have understood what had happened. I certainly didn't. For the most part, folk laughed to see a grown man cower back from a child. In that moment, my reputation for both temper and spirit was made, for before nightfall, the tale of the bastard standing up to his tormentor was all over the town. Nosey scrambled to his feet and fled with me. I had one glimpse of Cobb's face, taut with confusion, as he emerged from the kitchen, pies in hands, and saw Nosey and I flee. Had he been Burridge, I probably would have halted and trusted my safety to him. But he was not, and so I ran, letting Nosey take the lead. We fled through the trooping servants, just one more small boy and his dog racing about in the courtyard, and Nosey took me to what he obviously regarded as the safest place in the world. Far from the kitchen and the inner keep was our hollow,
Vixen had scraped out under a corner of a rickety outbuilding where sacks of peas and beans were stored. Here, Nosey had been whelped, in total defiance of Burridge, and here she had managed to keep her pups hidden for almost 3 days. Burridge himself had found her there. His smell was the first human smell Nosey could recall. It was a tight squeeze to get under the building, but once within, the den was warm and dry and semi-dark. Nosey huddled close to me, and I put my arm around him. Hidden there, our hearts soon eased down from their wild thumpings, and from calmness we passed into the deep, dreamless sleep reserved for warm spring afternoons and puppies. I came awake shivering hours later. It was full dark, and the tenuous warmth of the early spring day had fled. Nosey was awake as soon as I was, and together we scraped and slithered out of the den. There was a high night sky over Buckkeep, with stars shining bright and cold. The smell of the bay was stronger, as if the day smells of men and horses and cooking were temporary things that had to surrender each night to the ocean's power. We walked down deserted pathways, through exercise yards and past granaries, and the wine press. All was still and silent. As we drew closer to the inner keep, I saw torches still burning and heard voices still raised in talk. But it all seemed tired somehow, the last vestiges of revelry winding down before dawn came to lighten the skies. Still, we skirted the inner keep by a wide margin, having had enough of people. I found myself following Nosey back to the stables. As we drew near the heavy doors, I wondered how we would get in. But Nosey's tail began to wag wildly as we got closer, and then even my poor nose picked up Burridge's scent in the dark. He rose from the wooden crate he'd been seated on by the door.
"There you are," he said soothingly. "Come along, then. Come on."
And he stood and opened the heavy doors for us and led us in. We followed him through darkness, between rows of stalls, past grooms and handlers put up for the night in the stables, and then past our own horses and dogs and the stable boys who slept amongst them, and then to a staircase that climbed the wall that separated the stables from the mews. We followed Burridge up its creaking wooden treads, and then he opened another door. Dim yellow light from a guttering candle on a table blinded me temporarily. We followed Burridge into a slant-roofed chamber that smelled of Burridge and leather, and the oils and salves and herbs that were part of Burridge's trade. He shut the door firmly behind us, and as he came past us to kindle a fresh candle from the nearly spent one on the table, I smelled the sweetness of wine on him. The light spread, and Burridge seated himself on a wooden chair by the table. He looked different, dressed in fine thin cloth of brown and yellow, with a bit of silver chain across his jerkin. He put his hand out, palm up, on his knee, and Nosey went to him immediately. Burridge scratched his hanging ears, and then thumped his ribs affectionately, grimacing at the dust that rose from his coat. "You're a fine pair, the two of you," he said, speaking more to the pup than to me. "Look at you, filthy as beggars. I lied to my king today for you. First time ever in my life I've done that. Appears as if chivalry's fall from grace will take me down as well. Told him you were washed up and sound asleep, exhausted from your journey. He was not pleased he would have to wait to see you. But, luckily for us, he had weightier things to handle. Chivalry's abdication has upset a lot of lords. Some are seeing it as a chance to push for an advantage, and others are disgusted to be cheated of a king they admired. Shrewd's trying to calm them all.
He's letting it be noised about that Verity was the one who negotiated with the Chiorda this time. Those as will believe that shouldn't be allowed to walk about on their own. But they came to look at Verity anew, and wonder if and when he'd be their next king, and what kind of a king he would be. Chivalry's dumping it over and leaving for Witherwoods has stirred all the duchies as if he'd poked a stick in a hive. Burrich lifted his eyes from Nosey's eager face. "Well, Fitz, guess you got a taste of it today. Fair scared poor Cobb to death. You're running off like that. Now, are you hurt? Did anyone rough you up? I should have known there would be those who would blame all the stir on you. Come here, then. Come on."
When I hesitated, he moved over to a pallet of blankets made up near the fire and patted it invitingly.
"See? There's a place here for you, already. And there's bread and meat on the table for both of you." His words made me aware of the covered platter on the table.
"Flesh!" Nosey's senses confirmed, and I was suddenly full of the smell of the meat. Burrich laughed at our rush to the table, and silently approved how I shared a portion out to Nosey before filling my own jaws. We ate to repletion, for Burrich had not underestimated how hungry a pup and a boy would be after the day's misadventures. And then, despite our long nap earlier, the blankets so close to the fire were suddenly immensely inviting. Bellies full, we curled up with the flames baking our backs, and slept. When we awoke the next day, the sun was well risen and Burrich already gone. Nosey and I ate the heel of last night's loaf and gnawed the leftover bones clean before we descended from Burrich's quarters. No one challenged us, or appeared to take any notice of us. Outside, another day of chaos and revelry had begun. The keep was, if anything, more swollen with people. Their passage stirred the dust, and their mixing voices were an overlay to the shushing of the wind and the more distant muttering of the waves. Nosey drank it all in, every scent, every sight, every sound. The doubled sensory impact dizzied me. As I walked, I gathered from snatches of conversation that our arrival had coincided with some spring rite of merriment and gathering. Chivalry's abdication was still the main topic, but it did not prevent the puppet shows and jugglers from making every corner a stage for their antics. At least one puppet show had already incorporated chivalry's fall from grace into its bawdy comedy, and I stood anonymous in the crowd, and puzzled over dialogue about sowing the neighbors' fields that had the adults roaring with laughter. But very soon the crowds and the noise became oppressive for both of us, and I let Nosey know I wished to escape it all. We left the keep, passing out of the thick-walled gate, past guards intent upon flirting with the merrymakers as they came and went. One more boy and dog leaving on the heels of a fishmongering family were nothing to notice. And with no better distraction in sight, we followed the family as they wound their way down the streets away from the keep and toward the town of Buckkeep. We dropped farther and farther behind them, as new scents demanded that Nosey investigate, and then urinate at every corner, until it was just he and I wandering in the city. Buckkeep then was a windy, raw place. The streets were steep and crooked, with paving stones that rocked and shifted out of place under the weight of passing carts. The wind blasted my inland nostrils with the scent of beached kelp and fish guts, while the keening of the gulls and seabirds was an eerie melody above the rhythmic shushing of the waves. The town clings to the rocky black cliffs, much like limpets and barnacles cling to the pilings and quays that venture out into the bay. The houses were of stone and wood, with the more elaborate wooden ones built higher up the rocky face and cut more deeply into it. Buckkeep town was relatively quiet compared with the festivity and crowds up in the keep. Neither of us had the sense or experience to know the waterfront town was not the best place for a 6-year-old and a puppy to wander. Nosey and I explored eagerly, sniffing our way down Baker's Street and through a near-deserted market, and then along the warehouses and boat sheds that were the lowest level of the town. Here, the water was close, and we walked on wooden piers as often as we did sand and stone. Business here was going on as usual, with little allowance for the carnival atmospheres up in the keep. Ships must dock and unload as the rising and falling of the tides allow, and those who fish for a living must follow the schedules of the finned creatures, not those of men. We soon encountered children, some busy at the lesser tasks of their parents' crafts, but some idlers like ourselves. I fell in easily with them, with little need for introductions or any of the adult pleasantries. Most of them were older than I, but several were as young or younger. None of them seemed to think it odd that I should be out and about on my own. I was introduced to all the important sights of the city, including the swollen body of a cow that had washed up at the last tide. We visited a new fishing boat under construction at a dock littered with curling shavings and strong-smelling pitch spill. A fish-smoking rack left carelessly untended furnished a midday repast for a half-dozen of us. If the children I was with were more ragged and boisterous than those who passed at their chores, I did not notice. And had anyone told me I was passing the day with a pack of beggar brats denied entrance to the keep because of their light-fingered ways, I would have been shocked. At the time, I knew only that it was suddenly a lively and pleasant day, full of places to go and things to do. There were a few youngsters, larger and more rambunctious, who would have taken the opportunity to set the newcomer on his ear had Nosey not been with me and showing his teeth the first aggressive shove. But as I did not show any signs of wanting to challenge their leadership, I was allowed to follow. I was suitably impressed by all their secrets, and I would venture to say that by the end of the long afternoon I knew the poorer quarter of town better than many who had grown up above it. I was not asked for my name, but simply was called New Boy. The others had names as simple as Dirk or Carey, or as descriptive as Netpicker or Nosebleed. The last might have been a pretty little thing in better circumstances. She was a year or two older than I, but very outspoken and quick-witted. She got into one dispute with a big boy of 12, but she showed no fear of his fists, and her sharp-tongued taunts soon had everyone laughing at him. She took her victory calmly, and left me awed with her toughness. But the bruise on her face and thin arms were layered in shades of purple, blue, and yellow, while a crust of dried blood below one ear belied her name. Even so, Nosebleed was a lively one, her voice shriller than the gulls that wheeled above us. Late afternoon found Carey, Nosebleed, and me on a rocky shore beyond the netmender's racks, with Nosebleed teaching me to scour the rocks for tight-clinging sheel. These she levered off expertly with a sharpened stick. She was showing me how to use a nail to pry the chewy inmates out of their shells, when another girl hailed us with a shout. The neat blue cloak that blew around her and the leather shoes on her feet set her apart from my companions. Nor did she come to join our harvesting, but only came close enough to call, "Molly! Molly! He's looking for you high and low! He waked up near sober an hour ago, and took to calling you names as soon as he found you gone and the fire out." A look, mixed of defiance and fear, passed over Nosebleed's face. "Run away, Kidney, but take my thanks with you. I'll remember you next time the tides bear the